this here, was actually when we planned about a month before session, we had the Senate on board for coming with us. But the Senate sometimes does when things go mine, so unfortunately, we can't join the meeting. That, I think what we'll do is
just, oh, I'm sorry, it looked green to me. With that, what we'll do is just turn the floor over to Secretary Kaufman. And do you need one of these over here, over there?
I'm okay, Mr. Chairman, we've got the.
Oh, you guys, we're going to cut some FTE over here.
Chairman, please don't tell the JBC.
Secretary Kaufman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, and I certainly understand former Senator Wiseman, both of us having served in the State Senate, that there's an aging process there that occurs, and I think three blocks is a rather difficult journey for them over there. I think there's a rejuvenation process when one leaves the State Senate. But let me start. This is, of course, can everybody see this, or is this difficult to see?
Oh, yeah, there's one.
Aha, okay, we're okay. Okay, slide, please. Okay, this is obviously the mission of the department is no different than that of any other entity of state government. Our mission is to follow constitutional and statutory provisions and to implement and administer those. The administrative division, no different again than any other state agency in terms of its structure. Next slide, please. Elections division is kind of where the rubber meets the road in terms of your interaction, a lot of your interaction with this department. And so if you look down the list of things, ballot access, campaign finance, conduct of elections, lobbyist registration reporting, certification of voting equipment, National Voter Registration Act compliance, state abstract, HAVA, Help America Vote Act, requirements, citizens initiative and referendum. Let me elaborate in this area. First of all, we've got some working groups that were established. Obviously, the two of these were established under Secretary of State G.G. Dennis. I think given the controversy of the rulemaking process, that she has two working groups that she put in place prior to her leaving. One on elections, which has a cross-section of election lawyers to vet issues, before going into the rulemaking process. And then the other is on campaign finance. And so, again, a cross-section of folks, I think, of lobbyist lawyers. Holly, who can tell me is on that? What folks are on that? You know? Just their positions as the chair. Okay, clerks are on that. Okay. So sort of a cross-section of folks looking at campaign finance issues. We're putting together a third one now, and it deals with the disabled community in terms of their access to voting. In terms of legislation emanating from the Secretary of State's office in this session, we've got Senate Bill 83, Senator Tupa and Representative Wiseman, and that is a... Is essentially an omnibus, sort of a technical cleanup bill, with the exception of one provision, which I'm not sure I know how it got in there, but it is in the final draft of the bill, and I believe that Senator Tupa is supportive of this, as well as all the county clerks that I know of that have discussed this. But it is a very significant issue that you really got to take a very close look at, and it probably, quite frankly, shouldn't be in this bill. But again, it snuck in there. Senator Tupa, legislators are in charge of the destiny of legislation, and so I can only comment, but don't dictate on that. But the provision is this, and it essentially says that in primary elections, we will move to an option for counties to do a mail ballot only election. Right now, under current Colorado law, counties have an option to do a mail ballot election only in odd years, but not in a general election. So this is a significant change, a substantive issue on what was to be a technical cleanup bill. So that's something I think you're going to have to take a certainly close look at. We've got another omnibus campaign finance bill. Senator Gruff is looking at that now, and I believe Representative Wiseman would probably be the sponsor on that, going chair to chair. Military voting issue, that probably emanated from me, but Representative Joe Rice is carrying it in the House, and State Senator Steve Ward is carrying that in the Senate. Steve Ward, Senator Ward served in Afghanistan, Representative Rice served in Iraq, as did I. And essentially we have a problem. I was not able to vote in the last election, and neither was Representative Rice. We were both serving in Iraq roughly at the same time. However, I think the issue certainly that affected me was cleaned up by a rule change. But it is kind of illustrative of the problem. But the rule did address part of it. And it's this, and that is in Iraq and Afghanistan, the larger, more secure base camps have access to things, to ready access to email and normal mail and things like that. But when you're out in the forward operating base camps, you don't have that access. And so we have narrowly crafted this legislation to say that for submitting a request for an absentee ballot, that an officer can sign for other individuals within the same command and request that absentee ballot. It has to be, they have to be in, I think, what's called hostile fire, imminent danger pay. So we have a very firm classification for those. But to give you an example, when I was in Camp Fallujah, it was a larger, more secure base camp, where I had access to email and things like that. When I went out to Haditha in my last 2.5 months to establish local governments in the Western Euphrates River Valley, I rotated among very small forward operating bases where I didn't have that access. And so during an election time, I mean, that would be, it's very difficult for those people to be able to have the right to vote. And I think that's something that we need to make easier. And so this legislation moves in that direction. It also has some, I think another issue whereby, say, dependents of military personnel residing overseas in any areas, Europe under the NATO command, who turn 18, but whose home of records in Colorado, we make some allowances in terms of registration there that don't exist under current law to make that process a little bit easier. Thing, certainly objective, is the improvement of online filing as well as the website in terms of getting information, submitting and getting information on campaigns, whether they be candidates or simply committee groups, political committees. Statewide database. The Secretary of State's office of the state of Colorado right now is out of compliance with federal law in terms of implementation of the Help America Vote Act. And a big piece of that is certainly the development of a statewide database. And so the contract was canceled. I think by and large, the money was gotten back, I believe, from the contractor, but we had to start that process over again. It's moving well. I'm certainly staying on top of it to make sure that we are in compliance, we are in communications with the Justice Department, and they are content at this time with our progress in terms of having a statewide database that's a requirement of federal law. I think the other... And then the other requirement that we have on the electronic side, besides
the recertification
process, that's what I can read my own writing. the state was sued. The recertification is essentially We have four different vendors for electronic voting machines here in Colorado, and there is a requirement of the Secretary of State's office to go through what's called a certification process to ensure essentially the integrity of these machines in terms of their ability to accurately count votes, and the security and the integrity of those processes. The state was Colorado was sued, the Secretary of State's office was sued. The plaintiffs sought an injunction against the use of the electronic voting machines. The judge essentially mandated that the state did not go through an adequate certification process, needed to go through a tighter certification process, and that's essentially, we are engaged in that now in terms of going through that and making that determination on these electronic voting machines. And so we are engaged in that process as we speak. The next slide, please. Licensing division. That's all the filing requirements and corporate non-profit filing requirements for the state. There is an ongoing working group that's been in existence for quite some time that is very effective in terms of Keith Whitelaw, the chairman of that, the director, executive director of that division, and a group of lawyers, corporate lawyers, who are themselves engaged in utilizing our systems. And it's been an ongoing process of continually improving that. And I think there's a lot of consumer satisfaction in terms of the people that utilize that system. We have been in discussions with the Denver Chamber of Commerce in their desire to promote, in their view, economic development by even going a step further and making sure that our state's really at the very top of the list above Delaware, which is kind of the right now, I think, one of the top choices for incorporating businesses, and looking at what it would take to put Colorado on the top. And I think that that's really going to be a long work in progress, would be my guess, because it really, if you look at Delaware, it's not just their corporate filing system, but it goes into their legal system, in that they have specialized courts just for commercial litigation, something that we don't have in Colorado.
Secretary Kaufman, yeah. just if you could, for us, as you get to different divisions within, yeah, I know that you mentioned Keith, okay, but make sure that we recognize a name and a face. That would be probably helpful to.
We've got Holly Lauder, who's the division director on elections. Probably know the deputy secretary of state, almost said treasurer, Bill Hobbs. and then Keith Whitelaw, the division head for the business section. The next is information technology. I'm sorry, I think I skipped over licensing.
I got started licensing, and then okay. you kind of skipped into
okay,
business.
Okay, Mike Shea is the executive director for the licensing division. In licensing, we've got NEGO and RAFL licensing and enforcement. There's a number of other areas, charitable solicitation, notary, the notaries, we license and regulate those, and then administrative rules and electronic signature. Are there any questions on licensing? Next slide, please. Information technology. Those essentially technology systems and operations, software development. They essentially support all the operations of the Department of State in terms of technology. But the eFort is a statewide disaster recovery facility, which is where is it located?
Apple.
And Brian Belay is the executive director of that division. And essentially, that's not just for the Department of State, Colorado Department of State. That is for all agencies of state government. But we are in the lead in terms of establishing that. Yeah.
Thank you. A question I have on the overall IT. Of course, the Secretary of State's office had some problems a couple of years ago, and I know everything was replaced, as I recall. But can you give a little discussion on whether that's all been completely reconfigured, and are we good to go for a period of years, or did we just patch it up for a while, or what?
No. First of all, we don't have problems in the Secretary of State's office. We only have situations.
Oh, okay.
Some situations.
My apologies.
Some situations just happen to be worse than others. Brian, you want to talk about that?
That was a Marine Corps answer, by the way.
Mr. Carter, you did.
Now, yeah. We were made whole during that incident again, I'm Brian Belay, I'm the Chief Information Officer at Colorado Secretary of State's office. We were made whole. That incident happened in the summer of 2004. As you know, we got caught short by a very strange incident situation called Zinc Whiskers. It actually started the move to where we are right now, to this building. We had to vacate that facility. We bought all new equipment. And during the process, we realized that none of the state agencies had a DR capability, a second data center to fall back to. So we asked ourselves, what would other state agencies need in a situation like this? We came to various bodies, such as the business group that Keith Whitelaw is associated with directly. We came to bodies such as this, and we asked the IMC. We asked them the question, should we make an enterprise facility? And the secretary at the time thought it was a good idea. Everybody thought it was a good idea, so we built the facility as a byproduct, and I call this a silver lining to a gray cloud. The silver lining is that the end result was that we have a facility out at that area that all entities in state government are welcome to use the basic services that are offered. So, in essence, there is a data center here. It is in this building, and it is made whole. It has all brand new equipment, and all is good at this point. We feel very comfortable, and we want to thank you for all your help in getting us through those supplementals and those various problems that obstacles we had to overcome to accomplish what we have. Just by matter of fact, the zinc whiskers came from the floor, the raised floor, particles underneath. We are still in litigation. There's a court case, and the state's insurance company is suing the manufacturer of the flooring. I don't know any more than that, other than I'm going to be a witness there somehow, but because the state is self-insured.
Thank you. Have dialogue. You don't feel like you have to go for me unless it's out of control.
And you'll tell us if they get out of control. Yeah. I remember that. Thank you. Could you tell me how that location was selected, or what does the state go through to figure out this is where we need to have our data recovery center? Like, it's not in Cheyenne Mountain, which I understand I'm not going to use anymore anyway, but it's sort of like in the wide open.
Right. That is a really, really good question. And it was a real tough answer for a group. What we did is assemble a group of technical people from various agencies within the state, because all state agencies were welcome to use it. We got together and we found out that in IT, and as Representative Cadman can tell you, we think there are 34 data centers that the state of Colorado actually owns and operates. We think there are 34. I would tell you that I've been in the state for 18 years. I think there are about 12, and the rest are broom closets. Okay, we need to upgrade the quality of our data centers. So how was that chosen? We tried to isolate as many of the largest data centers as possible, draw a circle around it. We brought in an expert in DR process.
What's DR?
A disaster recovery. And that's the art of failing over to another data center when you lose a data center in its entirety. Usually, failures such as this are building specific. So we operated under that premise, because, you know, how much money do you want to throw at it? You're right. You could go into Cheyenne Mountain. Maybe that's a little bit overkill. I think most of the experts, the IMC commission, felt that that might be a little bit much. What it really comes down to is the current facility is 16 miles from any current state data center, and the contract we have requires, it's a public-private partnership with a company called ViaWest, a state of Colorado-owned company. And they have 5 data centers throughout the country. So in the contract, to kind of back up the 16 miles, contractually they have to be capable and ready to stand up a facility in Salt Lake City in 10 days. So they have to stand all our equipment back up in 10 days. So that was the process we used to try to get to the right answer. And it's a tough answer, and it's a good question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm kind of surprised that, you know, the zinc whiskers were the forcing issue on this after we've had 9/11 and a lot of other types of things. And I understand your requirements are different, for instance, the federal government or DOD, things like that. But one of the things that we could face is, you know, a homeland security type of attack, natural disaster, Yellowstone blows up, or whatever, fill in the blanks. Is this tied at all into a continuity of government requirement? For instance, if the state capital or if some of our senior state officers are, you know, somehow caught up in a natural or man-made disaster, is there consideration for how the information, the state archives and whatever are perpetuated into the future to recover from a statewide disaster, not just of ADP, but of government?
That, too, is a good question. I believe the former governor addressed that through the facility they call the MAC, which is down on Dry Creek, which is about 5 miles down from that, for a place where the leadership could build as a capital base to operate from. I believe used to be Camp George West. Is there an absolute mandate for the two to tie together? No. But we definitely try to tie them together. The idea of this facility was really more operational than a leadership perspective, although we did provide for about 16 desks there. So if a crisis, building specific, happened, we have shared desks there that are provisioned and ready to go. So leadership, whoever an agency might designate to use those desks to begin setting up for where we're going to take a group of people or the agency to operate from, they certainly could. You know, the size of our agencies are huge. You know, we cut 31,500 paychecks every month. We're the largest employer in the state of Colorado. We've got agencies that are 6,500 employees, like Human Services. So to try to facilitate something like that is far beyond our scope or capability. What we did try to provide is a data center where we could start the process of getting a second set of equipment built in a location, and purchase it on an enterprise basis, so we were able to leverage the buying power of the entire state. We bought it once. Yes, we set up the 35th data center. What we stopped from happening was 34 more duplicates being set up and moving to 68 data centers, because you need an alternate location. So it's an enterprise task, and I think, frankly, that's one of the beauties of it, is this is a case where the state got together as a whole and did one thing. We built one I-70. We all drive on it. Did I answer your question? Yeah, I can see.
Might also be the most vulnerable area to homeland security problems.
It could be. We welcome you to tour it. We had an opening tour on September 22nd. We certainly would love to show it to members.
I might like to discuss this more in the future. One of my little hobbies for the Air Force was disaster recovery of the Pentagon, and we had alternate facilities and so forth. Unfortunately, we didn't have any ADP connectivity or communications out of that facility, so I understand the importance of connecting the two, and you know, it all gets back to what requirements we have for this disaster and what kind of disasters we're really trying to recover from, you know, and that could have to do with dispersal of information, redundancy of information, all of the other things that that we have to consider. But what is absolutely essential for the state to recover initially you know, to carry on with business with as little interruption as possible. So
you know, you're absolutely right. And the what we provide is an overall place to start. Each agency is responsible for their own disaster recovery plan, and that all ties through the Office of Information Technologies and the IMC to kind of bring that together and make that happen.
You know, one thing that I failed to mention when we came across the administrative side is that you will all be considering enabling legislation on Amendment 41. And you're going to have to put it somewhere. And it is an independent agency, per se, or independent commission, but it's going to have to be housed somewhere for administrative support. And I would say to you that the Department of State is probably the logical place to put it, and that we have some hearing rooms that are available for them. Because these aren't full-time commissioners, these are part-time people that come in periodically, and that we could provide them administrative support in terms of setting up meetings and hearings and those things, as we already do on our own issues. And let me ask the Deputy Secretary of State to elaborate then on the nexus just a little bit more.
There's a number of things that, of course, we do already that are related to the general subject of ethics and government. I mean, we are a filing office for conflict of interest filings under the state ethics code. You file your personal financial disclosures here, your gift disclosure reports. The Secretary of State has, under the current state ethics code, has existing authority to issue advisory opinions to government officials and employees on their ethical obligations if they ask. Now, I'm assuming that the implementing legislation for Amendment 41 would likely change that, but there's a lot of people have expected us, have been asking us if we have a role to play with implementing Amendment 41, and of course, no, because it's an independent ethics commission that will be established. But again, there are those connections that might suggest that the Department of State would be a logical place to help support that independent commission.
Other questions?
I have one more slide in mind.
Okay. Okay, business.
Yeah, you hit a little areas of it.
Okay. The business division, I touched on that some, and that is all the filing requirements, corporations, nonprofits, organizations, and I think it's one of the reasons why it is successful, I think, besides the fact that I think it has a good staff, is the fact that it's had a lot of interaction, a lot of communication with its customers, which are, for instance, the Bar Association, corporate lawyers, and I think Keith Weiler established a working group. How long have you had that? Since 97. And I think that's certainly helped. And we are going in a number of other working groups that we formed, that have been formed since then, and that we're going into. To have that communications process with those that we're working with, that we're there to serve, in terms of making sure that we're doing the best that we can do and updating things accordingly.
The fee structure in the business division, I know, has been sort of floating over the last couple of years. I know that you know, for a while their electronic filings dropped to 99 cents because the fund balance was there. I'm not sure where they are now as far as the fee structure. Is there much, I don't want to call it pushback because that's probably the wrong terminology. Is there much pushback from businesses in what I've viewed as sort of inconsistent fee schedules? I mean, they sort of float, they seem to flow.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge in terms of trying not to have too much of a surplus, but trying to charge enough to meet our obligations here. Let me turn that to Keith. You want to address that?
Hi, Keith Whitelaw, Director of the Business Division. Fees are set pursuant to
24, 21, 104, something or another, to cover the direct and indirect costs of providing the service, which has been interpreted to say, well, if you're going to file a document and it comes in on paper and you have to have people and machines and filing cabinets and whatnot, what does it cost to approximate that direct and indirect cost? Okay, well, it's $10 or $100, whatever it might be. And then you front the capital cost of an online system. And I'm happy to say that over 99% of a lot of business documents are filed online now. And the thought has been, well, that's the filings happen, I never see them. The money just goes in the bank. So the question is, well, maybe that's more efficient, which is the idea. And if it is, then the fees should reflect that efficiency. We did come up with some marketing ideas to try to introduce online filing to folks back in 2002 when we first rolled out annual reports at 99 cents, which was 6 months, 2 bits or something like that. So that really was a temporary fee reduction, but we've had lower fees with respect to trade names. When we took over the trade name duties from revenue last May the 30th, and that program's going well. So we have looked at the fees as a way to address the mandate in the statute to recognize what the real costs are. And yeah, that probably has complicated the fee structure from time to time. We have a real effort, however, to consolidate the fees into just a few tiers. And this is supposedly easier than for users, and it's easier for us not to have to answer the phone. What's the fee for this or that? Well, if we have a simpler fee structure, that makes life easier for everybody. So we try to come back on course to that thought from time to time. Right now, with the ability which we appreciate getting from you to be able to mandate online filing, 24-21-111, and we've only pulled the pin on that once, and that was for trade names, although we'll use it for trademarks, which come out later. We will encourage, if not just simply require, use of what is the users, by their voting, by their usage, tell us is a good system. That will allow us to get away from the paper fees, which are sometimes 10 times what the other fee is. So we're in transition, you might say, as we leave the brick and mortar world and end up in a better place. Thank you.
Chairman, if I could, I'd like to have Dan Kopelman comment on where we are in the process of filing in the website, Representative Morgan Carroll's legislation, and where we are now with that.
Hi there, my name is Dan Kopelman. I'm the new elections technology manager, and I've been tasked with making sure that we're leveraging the technology for the elections division as best as possible. To that end, we've been asked to look at the legislative lobbying website and try to make some changes there that were more in line with the intent of the legislation, adding a specific section that is supposed to be up either at the end of today or tomorrow that lets you look up the lobbyists by bill number. I think it was a pretty major element in the legislation and unfortunately didn't get communicated through. I'm also working on Rule 45, which is the certification requirements that the Secretary spoke about, and that's part of an ongoing process. We're going to get the election equipment certified and look at the security concerns that came down at the very end of the last election.
Okay. You addressed it in terms of Representative Morgan Carroll's elections from last session.
1149. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So we got that. Okay. But our goal is certainly to improve the website and electronic filing.
Could you explain again? You're connecting lobbyists to bill numbers. What's the goal here? What are you trying to do?
Representative, one of the new pieces of information being collected and expanded on was the actual support or opposition of specific legislation by the lobbyists, and that information wasn't really being displayed anywhere and wasn't being shown as part of the reports that were generated. And so Representative Carroll wanted that put into the website, and had initially wanted that in there, and it just was not part of the display. And so it was a matter of looking at that and coming up with a way to address it and display that information in a comprehensive way.
It's on the General Assembly website you're talking about?
It's on the public lobbyists, lobbyist website.
And is this volitional on the part of the lobbyists? They can...
This is a legislative mandate that came to us. It just wasn't carried through, and so we just implemented it. It would pass last session of legislature.
And if I might add, I mean, I think each lobbyist is required to report the bill number. If there is a bill number, I mean, they might be working pre-session on a subject, but if there's a bill number, they're required to report it under last year's legislation. And then I think what we're implementing now is the ability to search by bill number.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, it's to search by the bill number and let you know the lobbyists and the company that they work for and where they stand on the specific legislation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could turn to staff for a minute just to see if there are any issues that came up that you think it needs a further elaboration, please chime in if any staff member thinks that we left something out. It's kind of a summary approach to this, but got it? Good. Yeah.
Yes, Secretary Hoffman, thank you. I have questions about the election part, because if you'll recall, you and Senator Gordon co-chaired a listening session, I guess you'd call it, or something. And one background question sort of is, what percentage of the Secretary of State's work concerns elections? Is it 50% of your work? Is it 10%? Can you quantify it?
I'll turn it over to the deputy on that.
Well, by FTE, by number of people in the department, we have about 120 employees. Uh-huh. And in the elections division, there's about 20. It's surprisingly a fairly small percentage overall, but obviously it's the one that probably gets the most attention by us and by everybody else. But
yes,
as far
you.
As expenditures, it probably is a much higher percentage. I don't know that I want to hazard a guess, because there are some very large, I mean, in the other divisions, most of our expenditures are pretty much for the personnel costs for the most part. In elections, we have expensive projects going on. For example, building the statewide voter registration system is about a $9.5 million project, for example. We are also required to reimburse local election officials a portion of their costs in administering elections. And last year that was increased by legislation, but that, I believe, is about $1.7 million each year that we help the county clerks with their costs. So in terms of cost, the percentage is much higher, but in terms of people, it's relatively low.
Thank you. And another question, Secretary Hoffman, you mentioned a bill, I think it's going to be Senate Bill 83, and you mentioned something, there was a part of it that you hadn't anticipated that, I guess, allows counties to vote by mail in all elections?
No, Representative, what the legislation would do
because
is that
they can
allow,
do that now, can't they?
No, they can only do it in odd years. They have an option in the odd year election. What this would allow them to do is, so there's no option in the general election at this time, mm-hmm. primary or general. What this would allow them in even years to have an option to conduct their primary election by essentially a mail ballot only system. Mail ballot only election. And so that's certainly a policy matter for the legislature to decide.
Does the Secretary of State's office have a position on maybe cost or accuracy or?
Well, I think that there's, I want to certainly look at the issue there are security concerns involved in a mail ballot election, certainly, that we're going to be looking at. There is the cost consideration is pretty compelling from the county's point of view. Mm-hmm. That they will tell you that with a low voter turnout primary election, you have to yet fully suit up. And those counties say that are still doing a precinct election versus a vote center. That's for a low voter turnout election, it's a fairly expensive proposition, and they would much rather conduct that election by using a mail ballot. This legislation doesn't mandate that they use that. It merely provides an option for them to conduct a mail ballot election.
And I think if I read you right, and then I'll go back, is that the concern is more of having this debate in a cleanup legislation kind of context rather than a solo debate on the topic.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it absolutely, shouldn't be in a bill that's a technical cleanup bill.
I understand. Had another question, but I just lost it. Thank you.
I have a question, and it's not related to our direct discussion here, but I think this is the format to ask this question in. You mentioned earlier filing for election and campaign information. And currently we are allowed in both manual filings and electronic filings, and just to put my cards on the table, I think that's the way it ought to be too, because paper and pencils really haven't been outlawed yet in Colorado, and I hope they aren't de facto officially either. But where is the Secretary of State's office with where are you with this? Are you trying to move out of the paper world entirely for campaign finance as well?
Representative Lundberg, it certainly would be a preference to move in that direction. However, there is legislation that will be before the General Assembly by Representative Bob Gardner that would, in fact, by virtue what they do right now, I believe there is a fee structure attached to a manual filing. Am I correct in that?
There's
a fee structure attached to a manual filing where there is not one attached to an electronic filing. The reason being is the fact that there are costs associated with having to input that information. What he would like to do is to eliminate the fee structure. We could only do that if we were to more aggressively move to electronic filing. And we would do so by this, if the legislation were to pass. We would say that provide some hardship exemption in the rule, that somebody would have to stay up first, some reason why they couldn't, why would it be burdensome for them to submit electronically versus manually, and that they would want to submit manually, that we would have to limit that number. The problem is this, I think. When you get into the heat of the campaign, and even so, what major campaigns sometimes will do for leverage is that let's say they don't want the media to have full access to their campaign report on the day that the filing is due. They will submit it manually instead of electronically so that you can't cross-reference, the media doesn't have access. And so, by virtue of maybe making the legislature were to go down the road of eliminating the fee structure, where we really didn't have individuals available that could do the data entry on a manual filing, we would really need to mitigate the manual filing, and we would do so then by that having that exemption. So certainly that large campaign, a congressional race, a governor's race, secretary of state's race, that wanted to you know, file manually for political purposes wouldn't be able to do so.
If I might just follow up with a couple of comments, and I will have done my due diligence to a constituent who was also the treasurer of my campaign, you know, and has been since 98. And I think it represents the interests of a lot of people as well, so it's not just a self-serving moment here at all. But, you know, possibly if one could simply elect one direction or the other and be pretty much locked into it for that campaign cycle might be part of the answer. But, you know, I'll give you the example that I have, that my treasurer, he's a very competent, qualified person to handle the records. That's why I have him. But he doesn't own a computer. And he has repeatedly stated to me, and we willingly, you know, go through the extra fee, we understand that, but he states it is, at least in his mind, not right that the state of Colorado would require that a citizen not only be literate, but have all the equipment. And he's computer literate, too. You know, I mean, at his office, he does everything, but when he comes home and does my work.
He's better off than I am.
You know, and I think that's an appropriate level, that we not be so technologically advanced that we rush past what is really a significant portion of the population, particularly when it comes to elections. Business, maybe a higher standard, but just I submit that.
Thank you, Representative Lundberg. I think that's a decision. I mean, if should that legislation be before you, I think that's a decision that you're going to have to make. Yeah, but if you do go to eliminating the fee structure, then we need to really push hard on electronic signature.
Thank you. I remember the question I forgot. excuse me. It's about the mail ballots. I think one of the things you mentioned was a concern about security of mail ballots. And I remember the member of the Oregon Election Commission, whoever it was, who came and testified, Oregon has had all mail elections for years and years and hasn't had any security problems. And I think what I read in the paper, I think it was the last couple of days, because we in Denver are voting on something on January 30th. And it turns out that I think the Election Commission didn't talk with the post office or something. And that's going to be a whole nother mess. I live in Denver. I'm getting tired of this, okay? What is your concern about security of mail ballots?
Well, Representative Labuda, whenever you have a situation, I think, where where the ballot is certainly, mailed to an address, I think we always have to worry about the security concerns of who fills out that ballot, and I think we can work on addressing that in terms of making sure that there's signature verification and that there's updated signature verification. So that's something we can certainly look at in the rulemaking process. I think that there are other concerns with nursing homes, or concerns with undue influence on people. Probably not significantly different than in an absentee ballot situation, but mm-hmm. magnified because it's an all mail ballot situation. But certainly, I think we do have to reflect on the fact that in, I think it was 2002, the voters in Colorado did have a mail ballot proposal before them and rejected that. What I would encourage the General Assembly, should they desire to move Colorado in that location, I would ask you to defer back to the voters, because it is such a profound change in the electoral process. And I always give deference when something has previously been referred to the voters, and the legislature wants to change that. In my view, there is an element of deference that they ought to give to the voters in referring it back to them to allow them to make that change. I don't think that giving counties an option in the primary election to decide the nominee of a given party, I don't believe that necessarily contradicts the will of the voters. I think the will of the voters, as expressed, was against an all-mail ballot for the general election.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Is there anything further, Secretary Hoffman, that you'd like to
let us know? Thank you very much. I really appreciate the fact that you've come out here. This is, I think, doesn't happen very often, I think, probably in the state of Colorado, that the committees of reference actually visit who they are the committees of reference for. So I appreciate the fact that you've done that.
Thank you. And thank the staff as well for taking time here. Mr. Hobbs. He's Mr. Coffin. You're Mr. Hobbs.
We both have the same amount of hair, so it kind of...
if you're willing, we'd love to give you a tour around the office. We'd like to show you the data center, the rest of the office, if you're available for us to lead you through the office.
I think I'd certainly like that, and certainly any members that have the time to do that, I'd absolutely understand if members want to head back a couple blocks and skip that. I certainly would take you up on that.
Thank you.
Meeting over.
Flip yourself out.
You don't live in Denver, do you? You don't live in Denver.
No, well, actually, when I'm up here this week,
I got one of those mail ballots where the yes and no were switched. And I don't care what they did. They counted half the votes wrong. Because half the people probably just automatically checked the top one.